Thank you for tuning in today and welcome back to another episode of The Source. I'm your host, Sam Raza. Today I'll be talking to Dimitri Discaris about Israel's assault in Gaza and the war in Ukraine. Dimitri Discaris is an independent journalist, lawyer who specializes in class actions, human rights, and international law. In 2020, he ran for the Green Party leadership in Canada, finishing second. Dimitri, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Zane. Good to see you.
Since you're a lawyer for international law, I would like to attain your assessment on a breaking issue that falls within your field of expertise that made headlines around Germany. On the 4th of April, Nicaragua brought before the International Court of Justice charges against Germany in which it claims it is facilitating genocide in Gaza. Nicaragua hopes that with a lawsuit it can activate emergency measures that include a stop to German military arms exports to Israel and a reversal to Germany's decision to halt funding for Palestine via the United Nations Relief and Work Agency, also known as UNRWA. One of Germany's leading news channels, the Tagesschau, in its primetime segment on April 8th, reported on this lawsuit, however, proceeded to also give its assessment on it by stating, quote, "Experts consider this lawsuit to be implausible. Aiding and abetting genocide presupposes that Israel intentionally kills civilians and that the German government knowingly and intentionally supports this," unquote. They also include a statement from the Director of International Law from the University of Bonn, in which he stated, quote, "I think it is completely out of question that Nicaragua's lawsuit will be successful. If it were to happen, it would be a serious blow to the credibility of the International Court of Justice," unquote. What do you make of the arguments that the Tagesschau brought forward in its report, namely the lack of an explicit intention of Israel as well as Germany when it comes to genocide? And secondly, if this lawsuit would be successful, it would be a major blow to the ICJ's credibility.
I think I want to say a couple of things, important background for our listeners before I answer the substance of your question. And that is, I'm actually a member of a legal team in Canada that has issued a demand letter on behalf of three Canadian Palestinians to the Canadian government to take steps, whatever steps are within its power, to prevent genocide in Gaza. And we are invoking Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. Because the Canadian government has not met our deadline of April 3rd to respond to our demand, we intend to proceed with this litigation. So I just want the listeners to know that this is something to which I, as a lawyer, am very much engaged, along with other lawyers in Canada who have expertise in international law. The other thing I should say by way of background is I haven't actually read Nicaragua's application. And so one question that I have, based upon what you've said and what these German academics said, is whether Nicaragua is only alleging aiding and abetting, because there is another provision, the provision that we're relying upon, which is Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. And that article requires all parties to the convention, including Germany, to prevent genocide. It's not simply a prohibition against aiding and abetting genocide. It actually imposes a positive obligation on the part of states that are parties to the convention to take measures to prevent it. And this is very important. That obligation isn't triggered only when there has been a final determination that genocide is happening. It is triggered when there is a material risk that genocide is happening. And merely by virtue of the determination of the International Court of Justice on January 26, that it was plausible that Israel was committing genocide within the meaning of the Genocide Convention, and that was a decision 15-2, and one of the two dissenting judges was the Israeli judge. So this was a very strong decision. Just by virtue of that decision alone, it is clear that the obligation to prevent genocide has been triggered. In other words, it's clear that there is a material risk that genocide is occurring. And there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the German government is violating that obligation. It has not taken, as far as I can tell, any concrete steps to prevent genocide. For example, cutting off the flow of weapons, imposing economic sanctions on Israel, prosecuting Israelis who have clearly committed war crimes in its domestic courts, or at least attempting to do so, advocating at the International Criminal Court that its prosecutor indict. I mean, there's a whole range of measures it could take. It's taken none of them. And some excellent reporting by your organization when you interviewed Shir Hever, and I watched that report, showed, as Scheer put it, that there is a shocking and tremendous amount of military weaponry that is being transferred, and this has been going on for some years now, from Germany to Israel. So with all due respect to these academics who are poo-pooing Nicaragua's application, I think it's crystal clear that Germany is violating its obligation under Article 1 to prevent genocide.
Let us switch to some regional developments related to Israel's assault in Gaza. Last week, Israel attacked and destroyed an Iranian consulate building in the Syrian capital of Damascus with an airstrike, killing 13 people, including Brigadier General Mohammad Razi Sahidi, known as one of the most prominent figures in the Iranian military. Israel also carried out an airstrike on the Syrian city of Aleppo in March, reportedly killing 53 people, including Syrian soldiers and Hezbollah members. Although Iran has condemned these attacks and even vowed retaliation, it has thus far avoided any direct confrontation with Israel. Fearing retaliation from Iran, the Israel Defense Force canceled home leaves and vacations for all of its combat troops. However, I would like to focus on Hezbollah, which is seen by many in the West as Iran's proxy. In the German mainstream media, Hezbollah is portrayed as a terrorist militia that is anti-Semitic and hostile to Israel and is bent on the complete destruction of all Jews and the state of Israel. Can you first comment on this portrayal of Hezbollah, and secondly talk about whether it's justified for Israel to attack Iran's proxies in Syria in order to defend itself?
Well, I've been to Lebanon three times in the past year, twice after the October 7th attacks in Israel. I have interviewed numerous people, low-level supporters, people who I think probably were involved in some military capacity with Hezbollah in the course of those visits. And most importantly, at the end of March, several weeks ago, I had the opportunity to interview the director of international relations of the political wing of Hezbollah, and his name is Ahmad al-Massawi. He was a former member of the Lebanese parliament. His brother was killed in 1988 in combat on Lebanese soil against Israel's occupying forces. So I've managed to, I think, amass on the ground a considerable amount of information about this organization. For what it's worth, Mr. al-Massawi is adamant that Hezbollah prohibits attacks on civilians. And he points out that if that is going to be the standard of determinations whether an organization is a terrorist organization or not, there is no organization in the region of West Asia today which is engaged in worse acts of terrorism than Israel. Israel has killed over 13,000, now approaching 14,000 children in Gaza since October 7th. It's starving many more. It's declared openly its intention, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, to deprive the people of Gaza, the entire population of Gaza, of food and water. And that's largely what they've been doing, with catastrophic effect. Whatever Hezbollah has done pales in comparison to what Israel has done. It also pales in comparison to what the United States and Britain have done in West Asia. They've killed vastly more civilians. In the current round of violence, according to Western figures, I'm talking about the violence on the southern border, the number of Israeli civilians who have been killed is somewhere in the range of 10 to 20, and the number of Lebanese civilians who have been killed is well over 50. And they are attacking all the way, the Israeli forces, to the northern regions of Lebanon, whereas Lebanon has confined its attacks, as far as I can tell, on military targets near the border. So I think there's a real issue here whether Hezbollah can fairly be called a terrorist organization. It certainly is hypocritical for us to say that about Hezbollah when we're not prepared to say that about Israel and the United States and Britain. And moreover, most of the governments in the world do not regard Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Now, when it comes to the attack, the Israeli attack, and this, by the way, is a perfect example of terrorism. This was a civilian target. There is no evidence whatsoever that it was being used to launch attacks against Israel. Even if there were people inside the consulate at that time, Iranian officials who had some involvement in organizing attacks, that does not allow Israel, it does not authorize Israel to destroy the consulate. This was, under international law, territory of Iran being used for civilian purposes. And if the presence, let's be very clear about this, if the presence in that consulate of officials of a government who are involved in terrorist activities or criminal activities under international law justifies the destruction of the consulate, that means that pretty much every Israeli consulate on planet Earth is fair game. Because in all of them, there are intelligence officials and military officials and sometimes even war criminals who are involved in the project of dispossession and genocide in Palestine. The fact is, under international law, none of these attacks are or would be legal. And the question here is, what is Iran going to do? I've seen they would be perfectly justified, by the way, again, as a matter of international law, in launching a direct and devastating attack on military targets in Israel. But I've seen reports that they have told the Biden administration that they will refrain from a commensurate measure of retaliation, something of equal severity, or perhaps even refrain from any retaliation at all, if Biden forces Netanyahu's regime to bring an end to the genocide in Gaza and implement a permanent ceasefire. I don't know whether those reports are true or not, but it's interesting that so far we haven't seen an attack by Iran. And Iran, with its missile capability, can very easily inflict upon Israel at least as much damage as Israel inflicted on Iran by destroying the consulate. So let us hope that cooler heads prevail, that these reports are true, and that the Biden administration will bring an end to the genocide in Gaza so that Iran will be given a face-saving way to refrain from retaliation.
Let us examine another incident that made major headlines in the West, especially in Germany. Last week, Israel attacked a convoy of a Western aid organization named World Central Kitchen, killing seven of its workers. As a result, many other aid organizations suspended their relief operations at a time when the humanitarian situation in Gaza is critical and millions of people are facing starvation and disease. Germany's leading news organization, the Tagesschau, provided a narrative the days following the incident that the US was quite vocal in its criticism of this attack and even put pressure on Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza, which it eventually proceeded to do. As a result of the mounting pressure, the Israeli Defense Force also dismissed two senior Israeli military officers and launched an internal investigation that found that those who conducted the attack were convinced that they were targeting Hamas operatives. All in all, Israel apologized for the attack and called it a grave mistake. However, no criminal charges have been announced thus far. Can you comment on this incident, in particular whether you believe that the United States and Israel's response have been sufficient and a positive step towards justice for the victims?
Let's start by noting that the leader of this organization, a chef from Spain, I believe his name is Chef Andre, has openly and publicly accused Israel of deliberately killing these aid workers. And this person is a close friend of Antony Blinken. He's so close to the Biden administration, the leader of the organization whose aid workers were massacred, that when the former Spanish Minister of Social Services, I believe her name was Yona Berra, in October or November, accused Israel with complete justification of committing genocide in Gaza, he castigated her publicly and accused her of being pro-Hamas. Okay, so the man who is now accusing Israel, the leader of this organization, of deliberately killing his aid workers, is as close to the Biden administration and was as much of a supporter of Israel as you can imagine. This is how egregious the evidence is here. What happened is these people notified the Israeli military that they were going to be traveling down a coastal road. They had cars which were marked in many ways to indicate that they were from this humanitarian aid organization and that they were civilian vehicles. There were three vehicles which were spread out. The Israelis targeted one with a drone, destroyed it. A second one came to its aid. When it showed up, they destroyed that one. The third one tried to escape and made such extensive efforts to escape that it left the coastal road because it thought it would be an easy target and went off on unpaved areas, and they still hunted it down and destroyed that one too. Again, clearly marked, they notified the Israeli military where they were going, and they killed them anyways. Now, people may say, well, why would Israel do this? Why would Israel do this? Precisely for the reason that you just implied. You talked about the fact that aid workers are now terrified about working in Gaza, even ones from Western states. Let's repeat, the defense minister of Israel said we are going to deprive the entire civilian population of food and water. What better way to do that than deter all humanitarian aid organizations from operating in Gaza? They are undermining the defense minister's stated objective, which is to starve the civilian population of Gaza. So no one should be, especially when you look at all the other atrocities Israel has committed, its destruction of hospitals, mosques, its murder of over 100 journalists. Another 200 aid workers, Palestinian ones, were massacred up until this point in time. And we could go on and on. No one should be surprised that Israel has done something as atrocious as this. And it actually fits logically within the criminal framework of what they are trying to accomplish. The response has been absolutely pathetic. Okay, let's recall that allegedly spiriting children, Ukrainian children out of a war zone, the prosecutor of the ICC swiftly indicted the sitting president of Russia. Here, what's happened is they murdered aid workers. They didn't just remove them against their will from some war zone, which is what the Russian president is alleged to have done. They actually murdered aid workers in addition to some 14,000 Palestinian children, thousands of women. What has the ICC done? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Is any Western government urging the ICC to indict even those two officers who were dismissed? Now we know there are two officers who are culpable to some degree. Has he indicted them? No. They should be tried by an independent tribunal with war crimes and crimes against humanity, and they should be held accountable in accordance with due process of law. And that would mean, by the standards of international law, effectively a life prison sentence. Instead, they've lost their jobs, and for all we know, they're now going to find lucrative employment in the private sector in Israel's military-industrial complex.
In March, Israel announced the largest Palestinian land seizure since 1993, around the time the Oslo Accords were signed. This seizure, or to be accurate, annexation of land, will be roughly 10 square kilometers in the West Bank. And according to the Israel-based human rights organization called B'Tselem, more than 40% of the West Bank is under the control of Israeli settlers. Although the West has routinely criticized Israel's annexation of Palestinian land, stating that it undermines the two-state solution, it has never backed it up with hard consequences such as sanctions or withdrawal of its military aid. Its sanctions merely target specific settlers who commit violence, but does not aim at the overall settlement policy of Israel. When Russia, for example, annexed Crimea in 2014, the West not only invoked international law, but also suspended Russia from the G8 group and imposed wide-ranging economic sanctions. Why do you think there's this double standard in how the West invokes international law and implements sanctions if we compare Ukraine to Palestine? And do you still think a two-state solution is attainable at this juncture?
Why? One word: oil. That's what this all comes down to. You know, in the aftermath of World War II, United States military planners identified the oil and gas resources of the Middle East, and these were their words, as a stupendous source of strategic power. By creating what is in effect a Western bulwark on the land of Palestinians in the aftermath of the Second World War, and then militarizing it and giving it, you know, the largest amount of U.S. military aid of any country by far in the history of the United States, what they effectively did was they created in this area that is a source of stupendous strategic power, a gigantic permanent U.S. military base. And that's the function that Israel serves for the United States military planners and for the neocons in Washington. And they are absolutely determined to make that military base as secure as possible. In order for them to do that, they feel they need to control the whole of historic Palestine, right up to the river, from the river to the sea. The river, the Jordan River, provides a natural bulwark against forces from predominantly Arab and Muslim states who might object to the presence of this colonial project on their borders. And so the way to acquire permanent control of all the land from the river to the sea, which, by the way, is the stated objective of Likud, the governing party, you have to eliminate the Palestinian population. You know, they're not going to put up with, eternal oppression, eternal subservience, eternal second-class status within their homeland. And they've made that abundantly clear, and they're prepared to employ armed resistance if necessary. So the Israelis have decided, and I think the West have decided, they're going to back them up in this project. They're going to do everything they can to force the Palestinians to abandon their homeland. And if they're not prepared to go, they will kill them. That is the clear objective here. No one should have any illusions about this at this stage. And so that's why the West is doing it, and the hypocrisy is absolutely grotesque. You know, I was in the West Bank. You ask, is the two-state solution possible? I was in the occupied West Bank 2 weeks ago, and I spent 10 days going to refugee camps, traveling from one end of the West Bank to the other, from Jenin all the way down to the border areas of the West Bank near Eilat, on the way to Eilat, on the Red Sea. And there are the settlement project is now so expansive within the West Bank that it is inconceivable, as the land is currently configured, that the Palestinians could have a sovereign and viable state. The only way that that could happen is for almost all of those settlements to be evacuated. And let's recall, first of all, that the government of Israel is ideologically aligned with the settlers. In fact, many of the leading figures in the Israeli government are from the settler movement. Secondly, these settlers are heavily armed and they're fanatical. If Israel actually did try to remove them from the West Bank, you know, there's a high risk that there would be a civil war, massive bloodshed, Israeli killing Israeli. So there's really no practical path at this stage because of the West's refusal to hold Israel accountable to a viable Palestinian state along the 1967 borders. And as a practical matter, for me, it should be up to the Israelis and the Palestinians to decide how to give Palestinians justice and preserve Israeli security. But the Israelis have eliminated the two-state option. What's left? It's either permanent subjugation and apartheid, or it's a one-state solution in which everyone has equal rights. And by the way, when I spoke to the International Director of Relations of Hezbollah, he said that in the opinion of his organization, Jews and Palestinians can and should live in peace side by side in one state. The problem is not the presence of Jewish people. The problem is Zionism.
I would like to switch gears to recent developments regarding the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and Ukraine. In March, Sweden became the 32nd country to join NATO. Last week, NATO also celebrated its 75-year anniversary at its headquarters in Brussels. At this event, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg proposed a $100 billion five-year fund for Ukraine, primarily financed by European countries. This proposal stems from the fear that Donald Trump might take an office in the United States in the future, which might lead to the US to make substantial cuts in its contribution to NATO and its support for Ukraine. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken at this event reaffirmed that NATO will continue to support Ukraine. And when it came to its accession to the alliance, Blinken told reporters, quote, "Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Our purpose at this summit is to help build a bridge to that membership," unquote. Firstly, can you talk about the major rise in military spending in Europe and how it will affect the social fabric and whether it would be enough to replace the United States as well as deter Russian aggression? And secondly, what implications do you think Ukraine's accession to NATO will have on global security and order if it would go into fruition?
Well, let's look at military spending, the balance of military spending before this round of increases. The collective military spending of NATO before the Russian invasion of Ukraine was approximately US $1.2 trillion annually. The collective military spending of Russia and China prior to, who by the way, have a much larger population collectively than the NATO countries collectively have. And economically speaking, they're roughly comparable at this stage to the economies of the NATO countries. And yet they were spending approximately, 25-30% of collective NATO military spending, somewhere in the range of $400 billion together versus $1.2 US trillion dollars. What possible reason could there be for the pre-existing levels of military spending to be inadequate when they're three times higher, Zane, three times higher at least than China's and Russia's military spending? And they're the ones who are identified as the threat, right? How could that not be adequate to keep us safe? I mean, what is going on here is that the military-industrial complex is out of control. They now control the purse strings of Western governments. It started in the United States. Dwight D. Eisenhower warned about this at the end of his presidency, about the uncontrolled avarice of the military-industrial complex. That phrase actually came from him. It morphed into a cancer that began to completely devour the budget of the United States government. And now this is happening in the rest of the West. It's happening in Canada, in Germany, in France. We need dramatically to roll back military spending. It is eliminating our capacity to deal with social, incredibly urgent social and environmental problems. It's heightening tension with other powers, principally Russia and China, causing them to increase their military spending. We're going to end up in an arms race, which could make the you know the Cold War look like a walk in the park, and we're going to bankrupt ourselves if, and quite possibly end up in a nuclear war. This is insane. The right thing to do, the rational and humane thing to do, is to roll back military spending, sit down at the table with the Russians and the Chinese, and start talking about nuclear disarmament, like Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev had the good sense to do a few decades ago. Whatever happened to the goal of nuclear disarmament? Ronald Reagan was one of the worst cold warriors of the Cold War, and even he had the good sense to see that this was a moral imperative.
Can you also address the implications that Ukraine's accession to NATO would have on global security and order?
It's hard to talk about that, Zane, because it's a fantasy. You know, I also think this talk about Ukraine becoming a member of the European Union. I don't believe for one second that the leaders of Europe are serious about this. If they were to allow Ukraine into the European Union or NATO, or even worse, both, that would become a huge burden for those two organizations, first of all. And secondly, it would potentially lead to an outright nuclear war with Russia. Russia is not going to tolerate, and it's been saying this since the 2008 Munich Security Conference, it will not tolerate a belligerent military alliance whose military spending vastly surpasses its own to be on its western border. It won't. And it's made very clear that that's not going to happen. And it's prepared to use massive conventional force, whatever you may think of the question whether Russia was provoked or not provoked, whether there was justification. The fact of the matter is that Russia will do everything possible to prevent Ukraine's accession to NATO. So even if the NATO leaders were serious about this, and frankly, I don't believe they are, it's going to result in a far more devastating war than we have currently experienced. And the war that's happened up until now, frankly, has destroyed Ukraine. Ukraine may never recover, certainly not in our lifetimes. That's what our policy of NATO expansion has led to. And frankly, I cannot for the life of me understand why Sweden and Finland wanted to be part of this organization. There was no point in the post-World War II period where Russia threatened them. There was no war. The same thing happened with Austria and Switzerland. They didn't enter NATO. They adopted a position of neutrality, but they were economically very oriented and politically towards the West. They just stayed out of the military alliance. Russia didn't attack them. In fact, the Soviet Union withdrew eastward after the Cold War. So it could have stopped the reunification of Germany. It had the military capacity to impede the reunification. It allowed that to happen peacefully. There's absolutely no reason for these states to believe that NATO membership is protecting them from an imminent threat. And there's every reason for them to believe that this is going to exacerbate tensions with a very large and powerful neighbor to their east.
Dimitris Karas, independent journalist and lawyer for international law, thank you so much for your time today.
Always great talking to you, Zane. Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in today. If you're watching our videos regularly, make sure to become a monthly supporter by instituting a standing order via Patreon, Better Place, or our bank account. We have 147,000 subscribers, and if all of our subscribers would just donate on a monthly basis, 2 to 3 euros, we will be able to cover our costs such as tax advising, insurance, website maintenance, video editing, translation, voiceover, and many others for the next 4 to 5 years. Since it's our principle to not take any money from corporations or governments, we only depend on you, our viewers, to continue our independent and critical journalism. And if you're watching our videos regularly, make sure to join our alternative channels on Rumble, Telegram, and a podcast called Podbean. YouTube, which is owned by Google, can shadow ban and censor us at any time, especially in times of crisis. And if this ever happens, we won't be able to reach you even with an announcement that we have been censored or shadow banned. I'm your host, Zain Raza. Thank you for watching today and see you next time.